Hey guys, Jim Cox, and I'm here today with an interview with Stefan Sommer, climate activist. He's here to talk a little bit about climate change, what's going on, how things are either improving or worsening, depending on your situation. And Stefan, thanks for taking the time to chat today.
James, thanks for making the time available to chat today.
I appreciate it. So tell us a little bit about your background. Where do you come from? How did you get engaged in what you do as far as being a climate activist?
Well, I'm a mostly retired professor at Northern Arizona University in the Department of Biological Sciences. And I'm the director of education with the Maryam Powell Center for Environmental Research. So my background is in ecology. All my degrees, my doctoral work is in something we call community ecology, which isn't about human community, but it's about studying how all the species in an ecological community manage to coexist. And with my studies in ecology, what I realized as I was teaching over the last 12 years, all of our ecological systems are now being affected by climate change. And so more and more I got into teaching courses like the Global Sustainability course, and a large component of that was climate change and its effects. And then as I've gotten closer to fully retiring from the university, I got involved with the Northern Arizona Climate Change Alliance. And I serve on the board of directors and I make lots of public presentations about different aspects of climate change. What are the effects? How do we know it's true? Because many people don't know it's true. And then what are the effects of it? And how does it affect migration? We have the year before last.
Yeah.
Because in 2019, there were 23.9 million people who fled their homes because of climate extremes of one sort or another.
Really? That's a huge number.
Yeah. So I also have a presentation about solutions. So building a path forward. How do we quickly move to where we need to get in terms of our emissions and the total amount of CO2 that we put in the atmosphere?
So, I mean, there's 20 different directions that we can go there. It's like, I guess that's the question, right? It's like when you're dealing with like an issue like this, where do you start? Like, what's the starting point when you have a society divided the way it is with what we're facing today, with the political situation in January 2021, and with this seeming fight over the interpretation of what's reality, you know, of whether it's, well, especially climate change, you know, denial of facts and science versus, you know, wanting to cling to your own visions of what was happy in the past.
Well, that's a really good starting point. You know, where I start depends usually on who I'm speaking with. So for folks who already know about climate change, it's more important to start, you know, how is it going to affect our life support systems on Earth? And how much has it already affected our life support systems on Earth? But for folks who, and it's not necessarily just science denial, because there's a lot of misinformation out there. And some folks who I talk to have guided me to websites where there's made up data or very selected data that they use to make a certain point, to make people doubt about climate change and question the real data that is also out there. But the real data are very clear. And this is not a matter of uncertainty within the scientific community. 99% of scientists understand fully what's happening with climate change and how it's affecting our agricultural systems, every aspect of our lives. And there, you know, there are a few folks who have bought into the money from the fossil fuel industry and they send out the counter message. And it's just really unfortunate how well they have managed to get into people's heads with that misinformation. We've now raised the average temperature of the Earth just over 1 degree centigrade. And so there's also aspects of just misunderstanding that have to do with, well, you know, so what? 1 degree centigrade? Well, shoot, yesterday the temperature ranged across 15 degrees. What's 1 degree? Well, but we're talking about the average temperature of the entire atmosphere and surface of the Earth. And so 1 degree centigrade change in that average temperature is just a massive amount of added heat.
Not only that, but also those, that 1 degree, it might be lower in certain areas like around the tropics and much more in the polar regions where obviously you're experiencing more melt and obviously it's more meaningful. It's an average, you know, the one.
Well, it's right? An average. And so the other thing about putting that much additional heat energy into the atmosphere and the oceans,
yeah,
is that that heat energy is what drives weather and climate. And so the more energy there is in the climate system, the more we expect extremes. When we first started, when the scientific community first started talking about this back in the 1800s, we talked about global warming. Then in the 1950s, when the fossil fuel industry started putting out their misinformation campaign and putting doubt in people's mind, we said, well, and the doubt would fall into place when people would see headlines about, oh, how cold it is right now. But really, it's a change in the average temperature. That doesn't mean we don't have cold periods and warm periods, but the average keeps going up. And so some people have gone from calling it global warming to calling it climate change. And then some folks have taken it a step further by calling it global weirding. I haven't really gone quite that far, but in essence, that's really what's happening. We now have climate patterns that are unprecedented, whole new things that are happening that we've never seen before. And then, you know, certain things that we have seen before are becoming more frequent. And so, yeah, it is really global weirding, but I think the best term still is global climate change.
So you mentioned 23 million migrants, climate refugees in 2019. Where were the predominance of the people who were affected by that? Like, what areas were creating those migrants?
It varies from year to year. In 2017, a lot of them were here in the United States because of huge numbers of wildfires that were burning people's homes to the ground, in some cases, entire cities to the ground, and many different hurricanes that displaced people. In 2019, I think more of it was in Southeast Asia, but a lot in Central America as well.
Yeah.
So one of the things that's happening in Central America is that the three countries, Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador, are in an area referred to as the Northern Triangle. And the climate change that's been happening there is to dry up the climate. So they're experiencing unprecedented droughts, but then also the variability. I have a friend who's a coffee farmer in El Salvador, and they'll have overall drought, but then suddenly they'll have a big rainfall that just floods everything out and causes mildew to grow, which devastates the crop. So a lot of the refugees that come to our southern border, and I'm in Flagstaff, Arizona, so our southern border here in Arizona, they're fleeing from those three countries, Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador, because of the way that climate change is affecting their ability to grow crops, and also because of some impact from hurricanes. So that usually doesn't get into the headlines. And when you dig deep, you can find it in some of the news media. But more commonly, you hear about people who are coming from those countries as being gang members, you know, and a bad set of people to be taking into our country. And it's just not the case. They don't want to leave their homes. It takes pretty extreme pressures of not able to support their families, actual starvation, before they'll pick up and say, we just can't make it here anymore. Uh-huh. They don't want to leave.
Yeah.
They're forced out.
So is there, what are the solutions to an issue like that then? You know, as the United States dealing with this issue, you know, obviously the solution over the past 4 years has been to throw up a wall and throw kids in cages, which obviously doesn't make any sense. And, you know, the level of inhumanity in a lot of the policies is, you know, mind-boggling. How does society deal with an issue where you have massive amounts of climate refugees, not just from other countries, but within the country? Like you said, California, the southern coast. I mean, people being displaced and having to, and being wiped out financially, having to start over.
Well, it's very difficult. I think that we need to stick with the principles that stand behind the Statue of Liberty. We need to be open to these people who are fleeing unlivable conditions or political issues in some cases where they are being mistreated, whether refugees for other reasons. But all of those folks, they're not picking up and leaving their homes just to come to the promised land of the United States. They are desperate. And so we need to treat them with decency when they come to our border. I'm not saying that we need to necessarily take everybody who shows up at the border, but we need to treat them with respect in any case, regardless mm-hmm. of what the political pressures might be. And, you know, not only were kids put in cages, but many of the adults ended up in prison camps of one sort or another, uh-huh. where they were exposed to COVID and had no option to get out or do anything to protect themselves. Uh-huh. So, you know, what we've been doing to people who come to our borders has really been inhumane.
Yeah, no doubt. So, I mean, it really requires a different, not just political philosophy, but a different more, a reevaluation of moral philosophy, you know, I guess at the core.
And I think going back to the old principles, uh-huh. this country, you know, we have a very strong Native American community, many different Native American communities who also need to be respected. But beyond that, we are a country of immigrants. We have prided ourselves as being a country of immigrants. And we need to get back to the principles, particularly with climate change, because we are one of the main countries responsible for climate change. There are other countries that have very large footprints, carbon footprints as well. But on a per capita basis, we beat everybody.
Yeah.
On a per capita basis, people in the United States use more resources and have larger carbon footprints than people in any other country. Uh-huh. So we've got a responsibility to those folks who are being displaced by climate change. People out in low-lying Pacific islands that are being flooded because of sea level rise. People in so many different ways, because climate affects so many different things. People are being affected and forced from their homes for so many different reasons that all relate to climate extremes.
So one of the, you mentioned the rise in temperatures, and even in 2020, with the economic slowdown that we had, it was, I think, one of the hottest years on record still, which goes to show that, you know, the effort that's going to require to turn the ship around is going to have to be massive and long lasting. When you talk about temperature increases, like, one of my big concerns is the effect on plants. And being an ecologist yourself, I mean, ultimately, that's an issue that affects global food supply, right? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. Well, and first of all, it affects plant species in natural ecosystems as well as in agricultural systems. And one of the things that happens is in natural ecosystems, plants can start germinating earlier in the spring because the snow cover's gone earlier and the temperatures are warm enough earlier. But in some cases, they're pollinators of these plants. They're tied into day length and they emerge on a schedule that's determined by day length as that changes throughout the seasons. And so it puts the plant flowering out of whack with the availability of pollinators. And this is screwing up the productivity of natural ecosystems in a big way. And of course, the same thing is happening in our agricultural ecosystems. So the good news is that here in Flagstaff, where we struggled to have enough of a growing season to ripen our tomatoes, the growing season is now longer. And as long as we have water to water those tomato plants, we're more likely to get ripe tomatoes as a result. But in other areas, farmers are having to shift what species of crop they plant, shift to things that are more drought tolerant and more heat tolerant. If you look at corn production, this is from the Wall Street Journal, I think in 2018, there was an article that pointed out that the value of corn growing land in the state of Iowa, one of our largest corn producing states, has been bouncing up and down. And our corn productivity has been bouncing up and down as a result of climate change. Now, northern Alberta has been putting in more and more acreage of corn to replace crops like winter wheat. And their corn productivity has been rising steadily, and the value of their corn producing land has been going up every year for decades. And this is because it's getting warmer up there. And if you look at the economic projections for different countries around the world put out by the World Bank, it shows that northern countries like Russia and Canada can expect stronger economies in the short run because of that increased agricultural productivity. And countries like the United States and others that are at slightly lower latitudes can expect to see less income from their agricultural output.
Who replaces, though, the winter wheat that is no longer being produced in Canada, though?
Well, I'm not enough of a few food specialist to know. I'm not sure where that's being made up.
In all likelihood, it's not. Right. I mean,
and maybe it's not. Maybe we're just shifting our diets already. There was a study in The Lancet from 2016 in which a bunch of diet medical doctors and researchers published what they think will be the outcome of climate change on human diet. And they were pointing out that, well, we'll have less meat in our diets, and that actually will have a positive effect on human health. But we'll also have less fruits and vegetables and more starvation. And they projected that by 2050, the reductions in agricultural productivity globally can be expected to result in, their average model said, 529,000 additional human deaths due to climate-related changes in human diet. So, and the upper end of those death estimates went over a billion. So it's a little bit difficult to model. It depends on how we shift our agricultural systems. Can we shift them fast enough? But we know that things are going to be coming to a very difficult point between now and 2050. This is not some way off in the future thing. This is something that's happening in the next couple decades.
Yeah.
That's why the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, is now saying, they were initially saying that we needed to reach net zero by 2050. But some of their panels are now calling for reaching that by 2030.
2030 in order to get to net zero. I mean,
and that's in order to, if we reach net zero by then we can avoid reaching 1.5 degrees centigrade warming. And some of the studies from the IPCC have shown that if we do reach 1.5 degrees, then the degree of melting of the permafrost and anaerobic degradation of biological materials deep in the ocean and so forth will boost more methane into the atmosphere. And so we can expect a major step in climate outcomes if we reach 1.5 degrees centigrade. And, you know, I don't know that it's really a step function. It's probably a very steep
exponential increase. Yeah. Just the rate of increase will accelerate.
Right. The second derivative is positive.
Yeah. So that all requires a much more progressive political dynamic than what we've seen over the past number of years. A lot of this has been pushed off to, well, we'll do incremental changes and eventually we'll get there in, like you said, 2050. But that's clearly, that option has sailed. So,
well, one way to look at that is we've put over 2.6 trillion tons of CO2 into the atmosphere already. We'll reach 1.5, somewhere around 3 trillion tons. So we've got 0.4 trillion tons more we can put into the atmosphere before we reach 1.5 degrees centigrade warming. What that means is the sooner we start reducing, the easier it will be to attain that goal. Thus, as we push that off more and more, there will be more for the next generation to do, and they will have to just drop all CO2 production, period, if they want to stay within that 3 trillion ton limit.
So let me ask you this, to go farther afield in this same topic. Is climate change simply a derivative, a result of capitalism? And do we need basically to change the system we operate by?
That's a very good question, and it's complicated. The answer is not simple. There's no question that one outcome of capitalism is massive consumption. One of the key tenets of capitalism is continual growth.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And both of those things have led to massive consumption, and that's all contributing to climate change. The other underlying thing, of course, is population growth.
Yeah.
So even if all 8.9 billion of us reduced our individual carbon footprints to the lowest possible level, let's say the per capita footprint of somebody living in Chad, you multiply that small footprint by 8.9 billion and you still have a massive footprint. So even if we got rid of capitalism, which kind of accelerates consumption, we would still be consuming and we would still be putting out massive amounts of CO2. In any case, we can't wait to reduce our carbon footprint until we can change our economic system. We need to change our carbon footprint right away. Uh-huh. And I think there are ways that we can do it within capitalistic systems. There are ways to regulate companies and their output. There are ways to regulate individual carbon output. There are ways to get people to consume less. And one of those is the way our United States culture has been for many decades now is to build in what's called planned obsolescence into our products. we make them in such a way that they can't be repaired. A lot of our electronics, one little thing goes wrong in the thing, there's nobody who can figure out what that one little thing is. And so you throw away the radio and buy a new one. And that's kind of built into our system. So those aspects of overconsumption can be regulated back into a more reasonable pattern where people are required to make repairable and long-lasting products. And we need to move to a culture where people expect their products to last a long time. Nowadays, some people say, well, your car lasted 10 years, that's great. You know, I'm not happy unless my car lasted at least 25. Mm-hmm. You know, why would we build something that would fall apart that quickly?
Yeah. No, I completely agree. And one of the things that such a change in terms of priority would do would obviously create jobs and opportunities for people to repair things, to create new opportunities that don't currently exist in terms of the current dynamic. But that gets back to valuing, you know, the role that the small business plays instead of super corporations. You know, currently it seems like corporations obviously have the cards stacked in their favor. So that's one of the things that clearly needs to change.
They hold more and more of the cards. Yeah, well, but it's also a cultural thing. So we need to shift to what I like to refer to as a culture of sustainability, in which we expect our products to be long lasting, in which we're always looking for new ways within our professional lives and our personal lives to reduce our carbon footprint and to minimize our impact on our life support systems. So it's not just about stopping to use paper. It's stopping to overconsume paper and insist that our corporations harvest forests in the most healthy, least impactful way and regrow those forests when they do cut them down. Uh-huh. You know, things like that. That doesn't mean fewer jobs. That means more jobs. Yeah. People going out and checking to make sure that forests are replanted, to make sure that the planting of trees, that those trees are surviving or fix it if they're not. So there's a lot involved in shifting all our cultural practices to better ways. But overall, just to shifting to a culture of sustainability and to alternative energy, renewable energy of one sort or another, there are huge job opportunities in that shift. Right now, they are just starting building a 477 megawatt wind power plant outside of Winslow, which is a city just to the east of Flagstaff. That will go a long ways to helping the city attain its net zero goals by the year 2030. We have a climate action and adaptation plan in Flagstaff, and it sets that goal. They just recently increased that goal from 2040 to 2030 in keeping with what the scientific community is calling for. But there are huge job opportunities because of over the last 4 years, we have been getting out of renewable energy. The government's programs that foster new installation of alternative energy have dried up and changed. We need to get back to that. We need to be promoting those technologies within our country because we have fallen behind China and many other countries who are now at the forefront of those markets. The IPCC calls for the entire world to shift to these alternative forms of energy. And we're not in a position to supply the world with those technologies. Mm-hmm. China is seeing further ahead, and they have positioned themselves very well to supply that demand that's coming up right now.
Yeah, and the irony from an economic standpoint is if you can drive down the average cost of your energy, which renewables do because you don't have any sort of raw input into that, unlike oil or coal or gas, you can actually be economically stronger and better off because you're more competitive. And that would, you know, go a long way towards improving our competitiveness. And this whole economic, you know, argument that sustainability is just, it's not affordable, that we can't afford to do it, is ridiculous. You know, it actually is the only way that we're going to be able to compete with the rest of the world.
We can't afford not to do it.
Exactly.
And we've had leadership that has taken us in the wrong direction in that area. And basically, the fossil fuel industry wants to protect its particular personal profits.
Yep.
They're not, when they try to sell you the idea that they are boosting the overall economy, no. They're just protecting their own individual profits and keeping others from being able to develop new energy markets, new energy technologies, and so forth. It's amazing to what degree the fossil fuel industry has duped the United States population into thinking that they are good for the economy. They're holding us back. They're keeping us locked into the dinosaur technologies, which are already fading. If you look at the stock market, people are divesting from fossil fuels. The large banks in the world will no longer loan to fossil fuel projects. So, you know, at some level, the global business world understands this. We just need to get the United States financial markets to go along with what everybody else is already doing and to try to go back to the forefront of it.
Yeah, the work that I do actually focuses on that aspect, divestment from fossil fuels and the banks that fund them. And one of the things that, you know, I think a lot of people don't realize is, you know, the fact is it's a way to manage risk for yourself financially, because they've been one of the biggest losers for the last number of years. And, you know, it's just not a successful investment at all. So why inflict that pain on your portfolio to begin with? So
and if you look at the cost
per
kilowatt hour for producing electricity from any kind of fossil fuel, whether it's coal, natural gas, or any of the other varieties of fossil fuels, wind and solar for the last 5 years have been cost competitive and are out competing every kind of fossil fuel.
Yep.
So it doesn't make sense to put in any new fossil fuel plants at all. Instead, we should be putting in the more cost effective wind and solar power plants.
Agree. One of the other things about fossil fuels in terms of this whole argument is the only way that they've been able to survive is by the fact that they've socialized a lot of the damages that they do, whether it's in terms of environmental impacts or methane release. I mean, all of these things are socialized costs that we'll have to deal with eventually. And it's not accounted for at all in terms of their balance sheets. So,
right. The human health costs are just not factored in.
Yeah.
And really, the fossil fuel industries kill thousands every year through air pollution, yet they're not held accountable for any of that. Instead, we give them subsidies. You know, so they're not cost competitive even after the way we subsidize them. It's crazy what we're doing.
It is. So one of the issues that you mentioned with your ability to grow tomatoes more effectively in Arizona now because of the temperature and so forth. The challenge, though, is water, right? Especially for an area like Arizona. So how does climate change affect the situation, let's say, in Arizona with the situation around water?
Well, and I should say, you know, Arizona is not one blank slate. I'm up in Flagstaff. So we're halfway up the side of a volcano at 7,000 feet elevation. We have snow on the ground right now. Hmm. So we're very different than much of the rest of Arizona.
Gotcha.
But in general, Arizona has been seeing more and more extreme droughts. And this is affecting our agricultural productivity. We already have the Central Arizona Project bringing water from the Colorado River to places like Phoenix. But the entire Great Basin and much of the drainage for the Colorado Plateau has seen lower and lower rainfall. So our dams are getting lower and lower levels. Our reserve of water is less and less. And this is just going to continue to intensify.
Are you seeing less snowfall in the Rockies that is also contributing to that decrease in water supply?
In the Rockies and the whole basin and range area between the Rockies and northern Arizona. Mm-hmm. And then Arizona itself is also seeing reductions in rainfall. So, yes, this is going to hurt us further. And we've got very large cities, Las Vegas, Phoenix, Denver even gets some of their water from the headwaters that used to feed the Colorado River, but now no longer do. So many millions of people are dependent on the water in the Colorado River, and it's going to continue to reduce.
So if it continues to reduce, I mean, at what point do those large cities become unsustainable to continue?
They're already unsustainable. The worst of that is going to hit in the coming decades. I'm not enough of a hydrologist to tell you exactly when, or even if somebody has made those projections, but it's not going to be that far into the future. It'll be before 2050. The city of Las Vegas has an intake that's at a certain depth within Lake Mead. Mm. And when the water level drops below that intake level, they're going to be in serious trouble. And they're already making plans for digging a lower tunnel to have a water intake that's deeper into the lake.
Mm. Wow.
So they know that bad times are coming. They're trying to prepare in the limited way that they can. But ultimately, the amount of water just will not support the number of people that we already have now. Many arguments have been made that the city of Phoenix is the least sustainable city on earth. And a good bit of that has to do with water, but then also the coming heat. We're lowering our water tables in many areas, and that means we're gonna have to pump from deeper down. So the electrical bill for that pumping is going to continue to rise. You know, and we're doing this at the same time that we're divesting from fossil fuels. The Navajo Generating Station, a big coal-fired power plant that was up on the Navajo Reservation within Arizona, was taken down just this past summer. This past fall. We have one more coal-fired power plant that's already partly shut down, and they're projecting that all three of our coal-fired power plants in northern Arizona will be shut down within the next 5 years. So that's one of the reasons that it's good for S-Power, the corporation that's putting in the Chevelon Butte wind power plant, to come into the picture to replace that. And hopefully we will have the job retraining that we need for people to shift from working in coal-fired power plants and in coal mining to installing and maintaining photovoltaic power plants and wind power plants. So that's part of an answer to your earlier question. How do we make this shift in a way that brings people along? And fortunately, I think we've got the 17 Sustainable Development Goals that were developed by the United Nations in answer to the catastrophe of World War II. And those 17 Sustainable Development Goals that evolved out of that time also include education of people, and that, largely that means re-education, to take on new occupations as we shift away from fossil fuels to alternative forms of energy. It's also going to take, you know, retraining in many, many areas.
Yeah.
The insurance, the Agricultural Insurance Agency, was one of the big businesses that first responded to climate change back in the 1970s. They recognized that there would be more agricultural losses due to climate extremes, and they changed all their actuarial tables back in the 70s. They realized that this was coming. Okay. And so this cascades to many, many different industries. We need to retrain people. We need to keep people, those people who struggle as we change to new ways of doing things. We need to have a safety net for them.
Yeah.
Make sure that they do not fall through the cracks in terms of poverty or starvation or any other related issues.
Yeah. And I mean, clearly in an age of COVID, that's just an additional stress laid on top of that framework, which, you know, injects more instability into the equation.
More strain and stress on people, for sure. I'm feeling it myself. You know, I stopped being able to go to the gym to work out back in March. Uh-huh. And since that time, I've been walking in the forest 6 miles every day.
Wow, impressive.
I've walked over 1,350 miles so far.
Congratulations, that's awesome. Day. That's good.
But I'm starting to feel it. You know, in the forest, I get to say hi to people, but, you know, at a slight distance, there aren't that many people out there. And I miss being able to just hang out with friends and shoot the breeze and play a game of cards or whatever. And it's stressful on people.
Yeah.
Now, the other thing about COVID, though, what COVID showed us is just how rapidly we can shift.
Yes.
Aspects of society. We went from in-person teaching classes, in-person meetings, working at a big building someplace, to telecommuting.
Yep.
For all those things overnight. And that has put a big dent in the size of our carbon footprint.
Yeah.
So we can shift. And so, yeah, my hope is that as we're shifting back out of COVID, the vaccine gets more broadly distributed, and we can go back to living life in connection with each other. I hope that we can maintain some of these telecommuting things that we've been doing and other ways that we've been saving energy since COVID. It's not that Zoom meetings don't take any juice. They do, but a lot less than having to commute for anywhere from 15 minutes to 2 hours.
Yeah.
If you're in Southern California, you know, it's crazy.
Yeah, no doubt. Or, you know, flying halfway across the country to do a meeting and then fly right back. I mean, the stuff put in the atmosphere is ridiculous compared to, you know, the benefit of what you're trying to do.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I hope that we can build back better. I hope that we can build back fossil free. We know what to do. Uh-huh. There's a 2017 article by Jacobson et al., mostly researchers out of Stanford University, engineers out of Stanford University, and some German institutions also. They published a plan called the Solutions Project, in which they showed how 139 countries across the globe could reach net zero by 2050 using technologies we already have in hand. And for different countries, you know, some countries have more wind resource, so for them they emphasize that. Others have tidal energy. So, you know, it's a slightly different mix for each country depending on the kinds of alternative energy that they can access. But we don't need new technologies. We need to implement technologies we already understand. And there are many people besides just the Jacobson group who have put together solid plans for how we can do this.
It's awesome. We're getting up onto the end of our time, and I appreciate your spending so much time and going into so much detail. If people want to learn more about the work that you do, or reach out to you. Do you have a website or email they could do that with?
Well, I mentioned that I work now with the Northern Arizona Climate Change Alliance. Mm-hmm. And the acronym is NAZCCA, N-A-Z-C-C-A. If you want to find out more about NAZCCA or see some of my presentations that are online, you can find them at www.nazcca.org. That's N-A-Z-C-C-A.org. And if anybody has more specific questions, feel free to reach out to me. I am still at Northern Arizona University, so my email is stefan.sommer@nau.edu, and that's stefan.sommer@nau.edu.
Awesome.
Feel free to reach out to me.
I appreciate it. Stefan, I would love to do some other programs maybe in the coming year on different topics, more kind of drilling down to some of these topics in more detail, if you don't mind. So we'll have to do this again.
Well, I'm always eager to talk, and we needed to have everybody understanding the basics of climate change so that when it comes time to make a decision between candidates, so that everybody can intelligently choose leaders who know what's going on and who have viable solutions that they can implement.
I appreciate it. Very good. I appreciate it, and I'll talk to you soon. Thanks, Stefan.
Thank you very much.